Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. If the cartoon shows a highway divided into 3 lanes for control freaks, clueless numbskulls, and passive aggressives, you immediately know that you have entered the world of Roz Chast. She's been called the poet laureate of urban neuroses, and the New Yorker's editor, David Remnick, says she's the magazine's only certifiable genius. In addition to collections of her New Yorker work, Ms. Chast has written and illustrated a range of books, including works for children, a memoir that won the National Book Critics Circle Award, and most recently, her national bestseller called Going Into Town, a love letter to New York, which Bloomsbury has just released in a paperback edition. I'm delighted that all of that brings Roz Chast to our show. Welcome.
Welcome to me and you.
You've said that you hated growing up in Brooklyn. Here we are in Brooklyn.
Yes.
But in Going Into Town, you offer thanks to New York as the only place where you feel you really fit in.
Brooklyn, at least the Brooklyn of my youth, it was very different. And Brooklyn was and is very different from Manhattan.
Well, Brooklyn now has become very different from Brooklyn.
Yes, yes. Where,
which neighborhood did you grow up in?
Flatbush.
Uh-huh. So near Brooklyn College?
Not very far. More like, you know Coney Island Avenue?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know Newkirk Avenue?
Yes, okay.
About a block away from that intersection.
Called the Golden Ghetto at one point.
Are you kidding
yeah.
me? Yeah, you are kidding me.
So has it changed much from when you lived there? Do you go back?
I went back there a couple of years ago, and it was actually not that different. There was one sort of a cafe that was sort of looked a little bit trendy, which was, you know, they served like coffee in rinsed out jam jars and things like that. And then they had like a handmade menu, and there were tables out on the sidewalk, and you know, so maybe there is some sort of stuff creeping in there. I don't know. But in other ways, not at all.
Didn't both your parents work for the New York public school system?
Absolutely. My mother was an assistant principal. My father was a high school foreign language teacher.
Does that put a lot of pressure on a kid to do well in school?
Yes, but you sort of know a little bit what the game is. It's like grades were very important. Doing well in tests was important, staying in the honors track was very important, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So if you checked those boxes, that was a good thing.
Now, what was it like being the child of older parents?
Not entirely great, kind of complicated. And also, it wasn't just that they were older. It was that in many ways they were very extremely old-fashioned. I mean, I saw this, I think I have a picture of it. I might have a picture of it in Going Into Town, a picture of me with my parents, and it's the 1960s. My parents look like they stepped out of 1938, which was, I think, the last time they actually looked to see what other people were wearing. You know, I mean, my mother still had that weird little curl on her forehead that she had, you know, discovered in the 1930s, and she wore these blouses that buttoned up the back, and they were very straight-laced, and I never saw my father in jeans or khakis or, God forbid, shorts. You know, forget that.
Even though they worked with other people who
yes.
looked a little more contemporary at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Did your parents subscribe to The New Yorker?
Yes, they did. They did.
How did they react when you began to be published there?
I think that they didn't quite know what to make of it. I think they were very proud, you know, because they knew what The New Yorker was, and they had friends who told them that it was, you know, significant. But I think they, like me, and like me still now, you know, wonder, like, is this like a one-shot deal? Is this like, you know, so can you make a living doing this? And I think that they thought for many years I would probably be an art teacher.
Was that okay with them? Because many academically oriented parents are disappointed when their kid says, I want to go to the Rhode Island School of Design and study art.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit weird for them. But, you know, I have to give them credit. They really did. I think that they understood that for me, art was really always the only thing I ever wanted to do. It was the only thing I could do, you know.
But as a cartoonist, or did you have hopes of becoming, at that time it would have been an abstract expressionist or a hard edge painter?
Never that. never that. For one thing, the paintings are too big. And, you know, it just like, then you'd have to be in a loft. And I was just not that kind of a person that just was like, no, I don't think so. I want hot water and I don't want to deal with people who might have diseases and things, you know.
Sounds like one of your cartoons.
Well, yeah. I think at some point I did know I was going to sort of trend towards being a cartoonist, also because cartoons involve writing and drawing, you know.
And was the style always kind of similar?
It started, well,
because you have such a distinctive style.
I started when I was about 12 or 13, when I discovered underground comics and Art Crumb and stuff. There was a lot of imitation of that at the beginning with the, you know, intense cross-hatching and, you know, stuff like that. But the more you draw, I think the more your own style starts to come out.
How did you happen to get that first cartoon published in The New Yorker?
It was actually quite a surprise to me. My goal at that time when I was 23 was to be a cartoonist for the Village Voice, because, you know, they published Jules Feiffer and Mark Allen Stamity. And
who has a new book out, by the way? Well, really wonderful.
McDoodle Street. Yeah. It's a reprint of an old book, which, and I have it. It's fantastic. I mean, I just love his stuff. And Stan Mack. And I felt like, you know, my stuff had more in common with that than it did with either underground comics or, you know, certainly newspaper strips. Forget, I didn't want to do that. And I liked New Yorker cartoons, but I didn't feel like my stuff had anything really in common with them.
Well, they were usually just one.
Yeah, they were one panel, generally, and there was a gag line under them. And so my stuff, you know, but I was starting to sell at that time to the National Lampoon and also to the Village Voice. And then one day I thought, I might as well try the New Yorker, you know. And I was not expecting anything. And I dropped off a portfolio of about like 60 cartoons, like a lot. I really had no idea how to do this. I didn't know who the editor was. I didn't know who William Shawn was. I didn't know anything. And I went back the next week to pick up my cartoons. And there was a note in there from Lee Loren saying to come back and see him.
He was then the cartoon editor.
He was then the cartoon editor, right. And he told me that they were going to buy a cartoon, which, you know, I was pretty shocked. But I still thought, well, this will be like a one-time thing. But he told me to start coming back every week, which is what I sort of do.
And do you know how many of your cartoons have been published over the past 40 years?
I think it's over 1,000 now. It might be, like, I don't know, 1,100, 1,200, something like that.
Looking back, has your style changed much?
I think it has. Some people, you know, I think that people who don't, I don't think it's changed, like, radically. I mean, I think about people like, you know, William Steig, who had, I think, at least three different sort of stylistic incarnations, from like Small Fry to this sort of stuff that he was doing in the 50s when he was very involved in, like, psychology and Reichian stuff.
He had his own orgone box.
Yes, I know. I heard that. Then he kind of became this incredible children's book illustrator. So he had these real sort of very separate styles, transitions. But I think for me, it's more just a kind of evolution.
Because I don't see that much of a change, but maybe the stories you tell have changed a bit. Do you still go to the magazine's office every week to submit your cartoons?
No. I submit them electronically.
Mm-hmm. Because for a long time, people just used to go there. And I know I've talked to Robert Mankoff, who was the cartoon editor for many years, and he would talk about how they would go over all the cartoons and then bring in the whoever was the editor of the magazine at the time. And
the art meeting.
And then readers would say, well, why did they pick that one?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't get that joke.
Yeah, well, that's the way it's always been, I guess.
Have things changed since Emma Allen replaced Bob Mankoff?
I think I'm sort of so wrapped up in my own stuff that, and since I don't go in there in person, not really. I mean, one thing that has changed for me is that a couple of years ago, I got an iPad Pro, and I don't own stock in the company, but I love it so much. And so I'm doing some drawing and collaging and stuff for the web, as separate from the regular cartoons, different thing.
Do you ever get rejected?
The seven words you must not use. I'm not going to say any of those, but...
You have an idea of why a certain cartoon is rejected, another one accepted?
No. I mean, I get... Here's the thing. I turn in, you know, six or seven cartoons every week. Some people turn in more. That's my number, six, seven, eight, you know, somewhere in there. And sometimes I turn in a cartoon that's a full page. It's a whole story. So I feel like that... You know, but I still count it as one. It's so ridiculous. And if I'm lucky, they take one. You know, so yeah, like 90% of what I do gets rejected.
I would then send it back in the next week if I thought it was really good.
I do. Maybe not the next week, but...
They will remember this.
Well, I think that they know that that's what people do, but I usually rework it because if I like an idea... I mean, there's cartoons I've submitted four or five times after, and I make a notation on the back so I know how many, and with the date. So after five times, I figure this is pathetic, and I'll, you know, retire it for at least, you know, 5 years or something.
On the other hand, you have an advantage over somebody who's less well known.
They could work the other way.
They're going to say, what's our Ross Chast cartoon going to be this issue?
Well, no, you could see the thing is, if you are a pessimistic person, you can interpret this like I have a disadvantage because every week I think, well, they're going to get completely tired of me. And, you know, that's the last cartoon they're ever going to buy, or they don't buy a cartoon. And it's like, well, you know, now they know, like, I'm terrible and I know that I suck. You know, oops.
You could say that word.
Okay, good.
Can you explain the title of your memoir? Can't we talk about something more pleasant?
That title actually came from something my father used to say a lot. If the topic got a little bit, like, bad, my mother was saying, do you know, like, Susan Rosenberg? She's in the hospital. She fell. They opened her up. She was full of cancer, you know, and then she would go on and on and on. My father would say, you know, Elizabeth, can we talk about something more pleasant? So that's where the title comes from him.
Usually in the cliche sex roles, it's the other way around. It's the wife who says, can't we say talk about something more pleasant? But your cartoons are autobiographical, but the memoir was perhaps even more personal?
Yes, the memoir was very personal.
Did it feel like a departure from the other work?
Not really a departure, kind of like... a continuation of a certain aspect of my work that, you know, the New Yorker is, you know, it's cartoons. And there were a lot of things in this, you know, the whole thing that happened, you know, with my parents. I mean, the book is really about my parents' last 10 years. And they lived, my father died at 95, my mother died at 97. So they had very full and long lives. You know, there were things that happened during that time that were funny and also things that were just, you know, incredibly sad. So, you know, it was more of a fleshed out sort of story.
As your parents aged, how did you come to realize that they were no longer able to take care of themselves?
It was sort of gradual and also sudden.
They were living in the same apartment that you'd grown up in?
Yes, they were living in the same apartment that I'd grown up in, and I hadn't gone to see them in their natural habitat in many, many years because I had moved up to Connecticut to raise my family with my husband. And they always came up to see me because, you know, two little kids in a tiny apartment, it was just, you know, plus after a drive all the way into the middle of Brooklyn, it just was not a great thing. So they would come up and they would stay with us. And then I finally did come out to visit them. It was really strange. And I remember exactly when, because it was the Sunday before the Tuesday that the World Trade Centers were hit, because it was like I woke up that day and it was just like, I got to go out to Brooklyn to see my parents in this way that was just so intense. It was like I just like propelled myself into Brooklyn practically. And I realized that they had moved into another stage of old age,
which we'll talk about in a moment. But I want to let my audience know that this is Leonard Lopate at Large, and I'm speaking with Roz Chass about a number of her books, including the reissue of her classic Going Into Town, which was a national bestseller when it was released, now out from Bloomsbury. She's the winner of the 2014 National Book Critics Circle Award for her memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? She is a staff cartoonist at The New Yorker, and she will also be appearing tonight at 7 p.m. at the Strand Bookstore on Broadway and 12th Street. Tickets required, I gather. We'll go into that a little later. But I want to stick to talking about your parents a bit more. What is geriatric grime, and why does it tend to accumulate in old people's homes?
Well, I think it makes perfect sense. I can see, you know, for myself how, you know, it's tiring to clean. And between the fact that it's tiring to clean and boring, and you have more important things to do, especially, you know, when you feel that, like, time is getting shorter, and also maybe your vision isn't quite as good, and also you get kind of used to things, you know, you get used to the grime. So I think there's a lot of factors.
Did you find that cartoons were an effective way of dealing with the absurdities of their old age and illness? When your father, who was suffering from dementia, got lost in his own apartment building, you did a cartoon that shows him surrounded by doors, 2A, 5H, and they're all the doors are sneering at.
Well, it must be terrifying. I mean, it's... I think for me, writing and drawing about things that are just, they're just too much to deal with. They're just too ridiculous and horrible.
And doing a cartoon in a way allows you to deal with it differently than you might if you were writing a short story.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
And also, it allows you to deal with things that... aren't always the most pleasant things.
Yeah.
Did your father ever look at some of your cartoons and say, can't we talk about something a bit more pleasant?
My father never did, but my mother once accuse me of using her and my father as material. Which of course was true, and which of course I denied, and we went on from there.
When you went through their apartment, how did you decide what you wanted to save and what you wanted to photograph? This book, Going Into Town, has any number of photographs.
Yeah. I think, you know, it was just very, it sounds like a kind of evasive answer, but it was just very instinctive. I mean, there were things that, like, I think with certain things, there were photographs and Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, like the cheese tainer. Mm-hmm. I felt like I can't really explain what this is. I'm going to take a photograph of it. And also, if I try to describe it with all the pieces of masking tape and how it had been in the refrigerator since I was in junior high and when they were fully capable of going to a store and buying a new one, people
they were
might
paid
think,
well enough, weren't they?
They were completely. My mother patched oven mitts. Hmm. I mean, an oven mitt is like $1.99 or something. It's
Children of the Depression.
Children
perhaps.
Of the Depression, absolutely. And also, I think in this babyish way, I thought, like, well, if I take a photograph, people will know I'm not making up a cheese tanner. I didn't just invent, you know, this object, you know, for fun. This really is it.
Was it hard to be frank about your own feelings of inadequacies in handling the situation?
I think in some ways it was easiest because it was like, I don't think it was so great of me to, I don't think I did such a great job at this. I think I could have been a lot better. I did
the best you could.
I did the best I could, you know.
But what did you worry about and what did you feel guilty about?
What didn't I? I felt bad, you know, how horrible it was making my parents move out of that apartment. Mm-hmm. I mean, their life was in Brooklyn. And to take them out of this place where they'd always lived, in that apartment where all their stuff was always around, they were able to do whatever they wanted. They had this freedom. And then you move people into an assisted living place. You take them out of their natural habitat. You put them in this place where nobody knows them, you know, where there are rules, where, yes, it was a very nice place, but, you know, there were rules.
But you had the advantage of being able to move your parents to closer to your home in Connecticut.
Yes, and that was why I did it, because I started to worry about them in Brooklyn when I was living at least 2 hours away where I was, because, you know, it's not just the distance from, where I was living in Connecticut to, let's say, Grand Central. It's like then you have the other leg from Grand Central to the middle of Brooklyn.
Which was another hour.
And, you know, as I talk about in going into town, driving is not my strong suit. So I did it once. I drove into Brooklyn when I was dealing with their apartment, and that like took years off my life. It was just a...
You had to learn to drive when you moved to Connecticut, I imagine.
Yes, at 38. Horrible.
Uh-huh. So do you mostly just drive to the mall and places like that?
I don't drive to the mall. I mean, I hate the mall, too. I drive to the train station. And then I go into New York, and then I can forget about the stupid car.
How well did your parents adjust to the I hate to call it the nursing
the place,
home or
the place? I called it the
place.
Yeah,
you called the place in the,
assisted living
in the thing. You say the place was like the high school cafeteria, but with old people.
Yes. It was just. I mean, it wasn't terrible. But the thing is, they had a life in Brooklyn. They had like a little bit of a social group. My mother was in a piano group. She was in a poetry group. My father was in a French group. They used to go to lectures at Brooklyn College. I mean, that was starting to sort of unravel by the time I got them out of their apartment. But to sort of move from this environment. And also, you know, I have to say, they were just a lot of like retired Jewish school teachers. It was like that was the people that were similar to whom they'd grown up with. You know, and suddenly they're in this kind of like place with like ladies who were snobbish and, you know, played bridge and, you know.
On the other hand, I'd imagine that their situation was not unique. I know of any number of elderly couples who have gone through something similar.
Yeah.
Including ones where one of them has dementia, and that just changes the whole dynamic.
Oh,
luckily, they were in an apartment house, so they had elevators, but many people in private homes, their bedroom is upstairs, and
horrible.
Suddenly they can't make it up to the bedroom.
Yeah. It's really, it's a big problem.
When you think of your parents now, do you remember them towards the end, or do you picture them when they were younger?
Kind of a mishmash, I guess.
Depends on what you're thinking about.
Yeah.
Can't we talk about something more pleasant? Won the 2014 National Book Critics Circle Award in the autobiography memoir section. It was also shortlisted for the National Book Award. Were you surprised that when it became such a sensation?
I was very surprised, yeah.
What kind of feedback did you get from readers who have aging parents or are themselves aging?
I got huge numbers emails from people, and sometimes handwritten letters too, from people who were going through this. Not just people who were going through it with my parents, but people themselves who were going through it. And it was really funny when the book came out and I started to give talks about it. I had had this like complete blind spot. And at first I was very afraid because I thought, like, what if somehow people who are older think that the book was really rude or terrible or cruel, and that I was just this horrible, selfish, you know, bitch, and, you know, and they're going to start like screaming at me or like throwing tomatoes or whatever. And that just did not happen. I mean, I'm not saying I didn't get any negative feedback, because occasionally I would get a letter from somebody, you know. I mean, one time I got a letter from somebody and it made me cry. It was just like, I can't believe you drew your mother on her deathbed. When my mother was dying, I got into bed with her. And you know, and at the time, I guess I was just feeling very vulnerable. And it was like, yes, I am horrible. I'm the most horrible person. But I think a lot of people just like this topic is just never talked about, you know, and we really need to talk about it because it's bad.
The cover of the most recently published book, the reissue of Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York, includes a drawing of you as a child on the subway with your mother. Were you following your father's advice to always have your token in your hand?
I do now, except it's a Metro card. Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, it's like, I will get my card in my hand when I leave my apartment.
Really?
Yes, absolutely.
Sometimes I pull it. I have a little sleeve on my wallet, and I pull it out just to reassure myself so that I know that when I get to the turnstile that it's just something I'll have easy access to. Well, but tokens, they could really weigh down your pockets or your bag.
Oh, horrible. I know. Yeah. Well, that drawing on the cover is actually, there's a photograph of me with my mother in the book. It might be at the very end, an old black and white photo. And I'm wearing like six sweaters under my coat. It just looks like my body looks like a pyramid with like a little like boop on top where my head is.
Your parents call going to Manhattan going into town.
Yes.
My Brooklyn parents used to call it going into the city.
Most people called it that. My friends called it going into the city. You want to go into the city? You know, but my parents called it going into town.
What drew your parents to go into town?
We would go see plays. They liked the theater. And we saw Oklahoma. We saw Carousel. They liked musicals. We saw Man of La Mancha. You know, they would take me into town to see plays.
But why did your father prefer to bring his own food into Manhattan rather than go into a restaurant? Manhattan is famous for its restaurants.
No, we never did. We never ate at a restaurant in Manhattan. It was so crazy. It was just, they just didn't trust it. It was expensive. There were like infinite reasons why we didn't. I think it was a combination of fear and also cheapness. Mm-hmm. I know, it's crazy. And, you know, he'd have like a wax. I still can picture the wax paper bag, you know. And
with a piece of honey cake.
Honey cake or like graham crackers or like a banana that was like turning brown. And
do you think that made him feel more secure?
Totally. Absolutely.
But as you said, your parents did not have to worry about money. This is something that gets passed on to the next generation. Do you sometimes ask yourself, why am I spending this much money on something?
Oh, God, yes, yes.
Even though you can afford it?
My husband was just yelling at me about that. I was like getting like all whiny and panicky about something. And he said, you know, just don't sweat like, you know, $3.99. It's just like, why are you doing that? And, you know, I bought these like little glasses wipes from Amazon because I was too lazy to go to the optometrist and see if you know, it was like $6. And
it felt exorbitant.
It felt like, do I really need them? You know, it's just really crazy.
I think this is something that's handed down from generation to generation. Yeah. Do you think your kids have those kinds of thoughts, or did you protect them from them?
I try to protect them, you know, as one does. But, you know, you never know. I'm sure that there are, you know, strands of anxiety that, you know, come through, whether I know they're coming through or not.
You're bringing up the Strand again.
Strand, yes, the Strand.
How many times do you do live events?
Not infrequently.
So do you have a speech that you give?
No, I'm actually, this one, I'm going to be in conversation with the wonderful photographer Billy Hayes. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, different things. I sometimes give talks and I show slides and stuff like that. PowerPoint, not actual slides.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large. Roz Chass, whose latest publication is her national best-selling book, available now in paperback, called Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York. Nothing changed at all? Sometimes people revise the book for the paperback edition.
No, that book is the same. Actually, I think it looks better in paperback.
Why were you trained as a child to never look directly at a stranger?
Oh, my God. Well, you know, growing up in Brooklyn, it was, you never really know, they could be a nut. And with my parents, it was a very, you just don't, you could set them off, you know, and nuts were very easily set off. So you just kind of, you got, you know, very good at just sort of evading trouble.
So you had to develop a sly, indirect way,
yes,
of looking at other people?
If you're interested in other people. And I always wanted to look at other people, but, you know, I'd have to look at them sort of slyly.
Well, your husband's from the Midwest.
Yes.
What did he make of all of that?
He is really different. He thinks I am kind of a nut because he looks at everybody because he's very friendly. But also he's a guy, you know. And so it's very different, especially if you're a young girl, like a teenage girl, to kind of look somebody directly in the eye. I think my parents were just trying to keep me safe, you know, without locking me up in the house.
Like many New Yorkers, you grew up in an apartment building. What are some aspects of apartment living that might seem strange to someone who's never lived in one?
Well, for one thing, I grew up with this consciousness that there were people all around me. And so after a certain time, you did not make a lot of noise. Like if I had my stupid record player on and it was like 9 o'clock, my father would come in and yell at me to turn it down because we had neighbors. There are clearly people who don't care, who have never lived in an apartment house or who just feel that it's, you know, there's no such thing as politeness, but.
Although it can work the other way. When I we only lived in apartments,
yeah,
when I was growing up. And I started hearing jazz coming up from the floor
true.
Below. I went downstairs. I was just a kid. I introduced myself.
Yeah.
He had turned out to be a photographer who photographed jazz musicians,
yeah,
among other things. We became fast friends. He would take me, even though I was underage, he would take me to Birdland and other jazz clubs.
Well,
it was, that's the other side of New York.
Well, in my building, above me, I still remember this, was this family. It sounded like somebody was banging on the floor with a hammer. And my mother went upstairs to talk to them because she had this crutch in the closet that she'd bang on the ceiling, mm-hmm, if somebody was making too much noise. And she came down. She said, "You won't believe this. They were banging on the kid, was banging on the floor with a hammer." And the parents didn't think to stop them. And underneath us was this couple that used to have horrible screaming fights. And I could hear it. And they would be like, I mean, just shrieking and screaming. So, you know, it wasn't like jazz, nice jazz playing. It was like screaming fights. I can't even remember any music. It was just screaming fights and people banging on the floor with a hammer. Not good.
So when you and your husband moved to suburban Connecticut, was that the first time that you lived in what New York apartment dwellers would call a private house?
Yes, it was. It was.
Did you ever figure out if you have a boiler or a furnace in your basement?
I still mix them up. I'm not sure. I know it has dials on it. I hate it. I hate it. I hate when it makes noise. I hate when it clonks on or clonks off. I just can't stand it.
Did you ever get used to the concept of owning a tree?
No, never, never. It's very weird, and I don't understand lawns. I still don't. You know, it's the stupidest thing.
I have a house with some trees that are 500 years old, and I realize that they're really on loan to me because they were there before me and they're going to be there after me.
Yes. And plus, but also you're responsible for them. So that's the other thing. I mean, we just had a pine tree come down with the wind the other day. And, you know, you have to deal with that. It's very weird.
On the other hand, you had to learn how to draw a tree.
Yes. I draw it. Ugh.
they're not so easy.
No. Drawing trees. And I don't know, kind of boring. I'd much rather draw buildings.
Your father never learned to drive, and you say you never became a confident driver?
No, I think if you learn to drive when you're over 30 or over 35, it never really comes naturally to you.
Any of your fears about moving to suburbia come to pass? You were afraid that you and your family would become obsessed with lawn care and maybe even horrors become Republicans?
This did not happen. I was so lucky for so many reasons. I had a very supportive husband who helped with childcare. And so, unlike a lot of women, I was able to keep working and keep drawing and keep submitting cartoons even when my kids were little.
You once told me that you would put your coat on, go out of the house, and then go upstairs for a back stairway so that you say, I'm going to work, so that your kids wouldn't come in and disturb you when you were working?
Yes, absolutely. This was mainly when Ian, my son, was little, and we lived in Park Slope. And I had a studio that was a closet, a giant, very large walk. It was like a railroad flat kind of thing. And there was a room in the middle of all the rooms that didn't have any windows. And that was my studio. And I would pretend to leave the house and then close the door. And once I sneezed and I heard him go, Mommy? And it was like,
caught.
I was caught, yeah.
Your cartoons have been described as very New York. Would you agree?
Probably, yeah.
Has living in Connecticut changed the work in any way?
I think having children, that was more of a topic. And yeah, I mean, I think that, as you said earlier, my work is somewhat autobiographical. And, you know, Bob Mankoff has said something very interesting about cartoons, how some people's cartoons take place completely within the cartoon universe, you know, with all the tropes of cartoons of, you know, whatever it is, the Tunnel of Love or, you know, the Grim Reaper, desk jokes, you know.
Imagining somebody nude walking by.
Right, just dozens and dozens of these tropes. And then other people's work is more autobiographical. And I think most of my work has more of its roots in like a kind of thing, funny things that happened to me, but I still like some of the tropes, you know, like Abominable Snowman or whatever. I mean, it just depends on what mood I'm in. But yeah, my work does reflect things that were in my life. So moving to Connecticut, definitely, you know, especially the driving aspect found its way into the cartoons, and especially having children did.
And the people you pass by are less likely to be of a different ethnic group.
In Connecticut?
Yeah. You go to the mall, does it feel like you're walking down some Brooklyn street?
I don't go to the mall very often. I actually don't leave the house that often. There's really nothing, no point.
It sounds like you're in a prison in Connecticut.
It's good for getting work done, you know. I mean, a part of it is that I hate to drive. I really, really hate to drive. And, I mean, I drive to the grocery store. And I take mental health walks to town, but it's not like, oh, I think I'm going to, that estate sale sounds really interesting, but it's over in, you know, some town that's 20
Fairfield.
Miles away. I'm not going to go there. No way.
How are your children's lives in suburbia different from your own childhood in Brooklyn? Did they enjoy visiting New York when they were young?
I took them into the city with me all the time. And Ian, when he was really little, really loved it right away. And he actually, when he was about 11 years old, we were walking down Fifth Avenue and it was like the sunny day, and he just looked down and he said something that was just like, it just surprised me because it was so profound in a way. He just said, God, it's so ugly, but it's so beautiful. And I thought, boy, he really kind of gets it. And he lives here now.
But they don't grow up with the things that New Yorkers do, like measuring a mile by picturing 20 blocks.
No, no.
Did it surprise you that your daughter thought a fire escape was a prop from the West Side Story?
She didn't know. I don't think that she thought it was a prop. She just called them West Side Story things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And then you going into town started as a personal project to help your, to give your daughter a sense of New York City, a guide to New York City?
Yes, yes, exactly. Because, well, I should interject here, and this is not, you know, it's a whole other topic, but my daughter is now my son. She's trans. Mm-hmm. So when he was, but when he went off to art school, he went to school in Manhattan, and I wanted to see how much he knew about just the basic geography of New York. It turned out very little because I sat him down. I said, well, first of all, I said, it's very hard to get lost because most of Manhattan is like a grid. So if you want to walk up from like 45th Street to 48th Street, you walk up three blocks. And he actually said to me, what's a block? And I thought maybe he was pulling my leg. But then I realized, no, because we don't really, we have some sidewalk in where I live, but not blocks.
But although there's that logical grid of most of Manhattan, you draw a map of the area below 14th Street as a tangled mess of spaghetti-like streets where Google is of no use. Road crosses Don't Ask Me Lane.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you often find yourself completely lost in that part of the city?
It's a little bit more dicey down there because also I have a horrible sense of direction. Just, you know, really profoundly bad. I'd say it's like reversed.
And then there used to be these complicated mathematical formulas to determining the cross streets for any address in Manhattan. Do you ever rely on those?
No, I had that. I had a card with those from, I think, an old bank, Manufacturers Hanover Trust. I can still sort of picture the card. And I kept it in my wallet. This was way back in the 80s, you know, before you just pull out your phone.
I've heard many New Yorkers brag that they've never been to the Statue of Liberty, the top of the Empire State Building, and probably would resist riding in a horse-drawn carriage through Central Park.
Well, those are three different things. I mean, I've never been to the Statue of Liberty, but I wouldn't want to brag about it. I just haven't. It's actually a little bit shameful, I think, but I just can't.
Well, they see it as something that tourists do, although I have been there.
Yeah, it's the Empire State Building, I have been a couple of times.
I think I went there because I was with somebody from out of town.
Yeah, yeah, the Empire State Building, I went there with at the time, my daughter. And the horse-drawn carriage is just an abomination. I mean, those poor horses, I would never want to do that.
You have all sorts of tips for people who are moving to New York for the first time. What's the safest thing to order when you're eating in a coffee shop?
A grilled cheese or omelet.
And why should you avoid entering an empty subway train?
That's you know, you're going to, the cars are all crowded and you see an empty train. That tells you that something is not good in that train. You know, it's not empty because nobody's noticed it's empty.
Sometimes there's just one person there, usually sleeping on a seat.
It could be a bad thing. Mm. It could be worse than that.
could you tell the story of what happened when you found a chef's knife on the street?
Yes, and it's actually a very interesting story because I found a chef's knife on 14th Street. This was a few years ago. And it was encased, it was new, it was encased in a white, like, cardboard sheath. And I picked it up and put it in my bag, and I was meeting my daughter then for dinner. And we had this great time, completely forgot about the knife, decided to go to the Empire State Building. And I hadn't been there, I think, since I was 17. So it was a good, you know, 40 years. And when we had to put our bags through security, and when my bag went through security, I guess, you know,
beep.
And a guard asked me if I had a knife in there. And I'm thinking, yeah, there's some knives on my Swiss Army knife keychain, you know. And I'm like, and then he pulls out this, you know, giant chef knife. And my kid is like looking and like trying not to laugh, and because, you know, she knew a little bit about this background, but I had completely forgotten when we went. But then this is actually interesting. these two women, and I can't remember the names, wrote me a letter saying, and that one of them was Asian Indian, and the other one was a woman of color. And both of them said that my privilege as a white middle-aged woman was, you know, had a lot more to do with the story than I had even thought about, which was that for them, picking up a knife on the sidewalk and then you just wouldn't do it. And one of them told a story about being, I think she said it, she was in Paris and she was with her husband and there was somebody had put a, had, there was a knife on the sidewalk that was like, an, like, somebody had like cut a soda can with it, and she was thinking, she got scared when she saw it because she thought a kid could pick it up and got hurt, get hurt, and so she wanted to pick it up. I think she was also Muslim, and she wanted to pick it up and throw it in the garbage, and her husband was just like, don't touch it, don't pick it up. So that was really interesting, and they did a comic about it that was sort of like mine, but they took it in a different direction, and I didn't feel like at all like, it was just like a, it's one of those things like, oh, my God, I never thought about it from that point of view.
In the little time we have left, I want to talk about some of the projects that you're involved with. You have a new project that's set in Brooklyn. And also, isn't Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant being developed into a half-hour TV series?
It's, you know, there's many, many a slip twixt the cup and the lip. I mean, you know.
Was written by Sheila Lawrence, who won an Emmy for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
I mean, hopefully.
And it's been directed by, or it's being directed by Ken Kwapis
of
The Office.
I don't like to jinx anything. So I'm like, you know, being very pessimistic. It's kind of like the way I'm thinking, like, yeah, Trump's going to win in 2020. You know, by my believing that, maybe it'll help it not happen.
You have gotten a little more political in some of your cartoons. You have a map of Trump's Africa that features Ecuador, Narnia, and the Belgian Congo.
Such a retard. Sorry for using that word. It's just so awful.
Your work has been shown in galleries and museums. Do you think that viewers respond differently when they see them on the wall?
I hope they still laugh. I hope they still find it funny.
And you've exhibited examples of your Ukrainian-style decorated eggs and your hooked rugs. Have you always been a crafter?
I think, it, you know, as my husband says, when I'm busy, I don't like fall into like a worry spirals, so I like to be busy with things.
One of the things that probably has come as a pleasant surprise is that cartoons and graphic books have been getting a lot more respect in recent years.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, some of that we have Art Spiegelman to thank for, you know, with Mouse, which I think really put adult graphic memoirs and novels on the map in a way that they weren't before.
So you're going to be appearing tonight at 7 o'clock at the Strand Bookstore on Broadway and 12th Street. Tickets are required. How do people get tickets? You don't know?
I don't know.
I guess people can get in touch with the Strand, which is has a series of events.
Yeah.
But the Strand has been resisting being declared a national landmark, which is kind of odd since it is one of the great landmarks of New York City. One of the only survivors of a time when I was a kid, when Fourth Avenue down below Union Square was all bookstores.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah. I mean, we're not that far apart in age. I remember that.
Do you know why they don't want to be landmark?
I think it has something to do with money, but I'm not sure.
As I understand it, if you're landmarked, then that means you can't change things. And they had an explosion, a manhole explosion recently, and they had to fix the store up, and they would have had to get all sorts of special permits to have it fixed, so they would rather not do it.
Yeah, well, then that makes sense. Hmm.
Meanwhile, another book in the works?
Yes. It's going to be about dreams.
About?
Dreams.
Dreams, And as I said, there's a project involving Brooklyn. What's that?
That is not going to happen for now.
Things get started and then don't.
Yes, exactly.
But meanwhile, we have this wonderful book, Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York, and many New Yorkers who grew up here how many years ago, would you say?
How many did I grow up? How many years ago?
Well, that this book covers.
Oh, I guess if it started when I was a kid, I probably like at the tail end of the 50s, early 60s. But it's not really, it's more a guide. I mean, that's, it's sort of based around the guide that I wrote for my daughter. It's not really a memoir of growing up in
New York. Yeah, but people will still recognize a lot of things in their own lives just looking at this
book. It's a sort of personal guide, I guess.
And it's published in paperback now by Bloomsbury Rosschest. It's been such a pleasure talking with you again.
You too. Nice to see you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Rosschest, to Barbara Kahn, who produced today's show, to Reggie Johnson, who was at, actually, I think it was Deb Freeman who produced today's show. Reggie Johnson was at the audio controls. Charlie Morrow composed our theme music, and special thanks to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate and Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.